Informed Dissent, the intersection of healthcare and politics, with Dr. Jeff Barkey, board-certified primary care physician, and Dr. Mark McDonald, board-certified child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist.
This episode is brought to you by Rogers Hood Apothecary.
Here are seven signs you may have a parasite. My biggest issue, because I did have parasites, was teeth grinding, skin irritation, and unexplained digestive issues. The other indication that you could have a parasite is eating after 7 p.m. and craving sugar. My name is Kim. I'm the Worm Queen and the inventor of the Parify Kit. Let's go over it. Parify, it's your parasite cleanse. Sustain, it's your candida and your bad bacteria cleanse. Metal Flush, it's your heavy metal detox. Cinnabon, it's your binder. The kit comes with instructions. We have a nut-free option. We ship worldwide. The Parify Kit is for ages 3 and up. Use IDM as your 10% discount code. Find it on rogershood.com.
Hey, Mark, welcome back. Another great episode of Informed Dissent.
I can see you and your cat today, although our listeners cannot. I hope that the cat doesn't interrupt the microphone.
Yeah, no, Larry is here. Larry's growing up. He's about 8 months now. And by the way, Larry's balls are going to need to be cut off soon.
Oh, I'm wincing just hearing those words.
So I'm told they get to be this age, and if you don't cut their balls off, they start spraying the house because that's what males do. So maybe we'll do a podcast episode live with Larry being neutered. We talk a lot about that.
This on the heels of live water birth video that you were threatening to do last fall.
Our podcast producer, Natalie, of course, just had a baby recently, and she used a midwife, but she wouldn't let us live stream her birth, unfortunately. maybe she'll be less modest the next time, and we'll do that. We'll see.
After the first two or three kids, it's like everything goes out the window at that point.
So our push to holistic health, we've got a great guest on today, and that's Michael Coomer. And Michael's website or Instagram site, you should check it out, M Coomer, K-U-M-M-E-R 82. He says, helping you improve your health and longevity. Well, we try to do that too, and it'll be an interesting conversation. So Michael, welcome to Informed Dissent.
I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, great. Where are you, by the way, in the country?
I'm in Atlanta, north of Atlanta.
Okay. All right, very good. So Mark and I are both in Southern California here. So how did you end up with an Instagram site and helping people to try to improve their health and longevity?
Yeah, I was really born out of people asking me questions and I had to repeat myself all the time. So I figured if I put the information somewhere, like I can just point them to where to look rather than me having to say the same thing over and over again. But it wasn't really born out of health and fitness at all. I started blogging in 2012 about health, but not health, about technology and photography, which were my passions at the time. And then over time, it developed into, I realized that maybe the way we are eating is not so great. And we got into a paleo diet where we got into cutting our sugars and we got into paleo, we got into fasting, keto, carnivore, animal-based, and then all the things that go with it. Homesteading was kind of the latest adventure, I guess. And along the way, I figured if I put out what I know, then other people can hopefully take a shortcut and don't have to go through a 12-year journey to end up where I am.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think the biggest mistakes people make in their nutrition?
I think it's just listening to mainstream advice and not questioning anything that someone with authority tells you. I think that's really the biggest. If you go, you know, and get your annual physical or whatever, go to a regular doctor and they tell you, hey, you should be eating ABC, but not XYZ. Most people just blindly follow and don't think about, does this even make sense? Where did that doctor get his information from? Is that information from 40 years ago, from the little nutritional teaching that was done in medical school, if any? Or is this really based on, well, how humans have been living for a very long time and paired with the latest scientific evidence, if it makes sense to apply?
Right. So I get it. Listening to propaganda and so forth is the big mistake. But specifically, what kind of foods should people avoid? What mistakes do they make that are easy to clean up?
I think the biggest one is believing that all vegetables are good for us, that veggies are meant to be consumed, that veggies want us to eat them, especially specific parts of the plant that just want to be eaten because it doesn't interfere with the plant survival at all. I think that's really the biggest mistake, to think that everything is rainbow color is necessarily good for us, and meat and, you know, animal products, probably not so much.
So the plant paradox was written, I think that's Dr. Gundry. Mm-hmm. And I've heard Paul Saladino at the supermarket with a big head of broccoli saying broccoli is bullshit. So your feeling is, generally speaking, somebody isn't going to get healthy by eating tons of vegetables.
No. So I think if you don't know how to process certain vegetables, humans have certainly learned to mitigate many of the plant toxins. So I would not necessarily say that everything is bad, and unless you know how to process that. But I do believe that there is not really much in plants. And of course, we eating processed foods and garbage food is obviously potentially even worse. But for those who want to do better, who say, you know what, I'm going to remove the Burger King and the McDonald's and all the processed junk food, I'm going to go with real foods. And then very often they lead towards, well, it's got to be plant-based because everything that looks green is healthy for us. And I think that's a big misconception and misunderstanding of how the human body metabolizes and uses the nutrients in those foods.
So we're recording this late in the afternoon for me and Mark, and early evening for you. What do you have to eat today? Tell us what your diet consisted of.
I only had a very late breakfast today around lunchtime, actually, and that consisted of a bunch of eggs from our backyard, a raw milk kefir that I made, and some collagen powder that I'm testing right now, mixed into the kefir.
Mark, it's funny. You and I talked before we went live. You published an article on your Substack, Dissident MD, DissIdent. I recommend this to everybody. You are an excellent writer. You engage the audience. You don't write above people's heads. It's very accessible. This is an article, and I actually printed it. I don't usually print a lot, but I printed it because I'm going to post this on my Instagram and talk about it. And that is, there's an article that came out not long ago that said, basically, if you do intermittent fasting, you're going to kill yourself. And your article is titled, "Fasting Kills You," reports American Heart Association. Mm-hmm. And then you still recommend intermittent fasting. And you looked at this article written by the American Heart Association, and most people only read headlines. Most people don't know how to read any scientific information. They won't dissect it. And as a result, they believe what the headlines say. And especially if the American Medical Association says it, it must be true. Never mind, they continue to recommend that people get their COVID booster. Never mind, the American Medical Association recommends that 6 months old get a COVID shot. And the American Medical Association recommends that I ask all my patients if they have any guns in the house. But besides that, they're a perfectly credible organization. So talk about how you came about writing this article, Mark.
I came across a mainstream legacy media feed, and actually multiples, over the course of about 24 hours announcing this alarming, absolutely terrifying announcement that there's a 91% correlation between intermittent fasting and death. Not increased risk of heart disease, death. And the study size was huge. It was over 20,000 people and was over a number of years. And I thought, well, this is a pretty serious study. So I clicked on the link to the study, and what popped up was not a study, but a poster. And posters, for those who haven't gone to medical school, are basically like advertisements for studies that are ongoing or that you haven't yet published. It's what students use as a kind of banner on the hallway to say, hey, come and look at what I'm researching. This is what I've found. And I looked around on the poster, and as I looked at it more carefully, I realized that not only is there really no causation here, it's simply a correlation, but the study was very poorly designed. It was really just a retrospective review of participant engaged diet records of what they reported to have eaten. And as you noted, Jeff, those that were considered intermittent fasters only fasted twice, meaning 2 days out of the entire period of the study, which was months to years long. And we have no idea whether those people who fasted for 2 days were fat, whether they had diabetes, whether they were smokers, drug addicts. There was absolutely no controls in the study. So we really don't know anything except that everybody's now very emotionally concerned and impassioned about fasting. And it led me to think, we really need, we meaning everybody here in the United States who cares about their health, really needs to know that when they read something that says, don't do this or do that, if it doesn't make sense, if it sounds kind of strange, there's probably something behind it that's nefarious. Now, I don't know if there's a nefarious motivation behind this article by the AHA or not, but I'm suspicious because a day or two later, another article came out showing that all the studies from the Wim Hof Association, Wim Hof is the famous northerner in Europe who promotes cold plunges to help with your health, that cold plunges are actually going to kill you. So it's like this string of practices, eating non-processed food, or as you say, Jeff, eating or drinking non-homogenized and non-pasteurized milk, that's going to kill you. Intermittent fasting is going to kill you. Going outside and getting sunlight is going to kill you. All of the things that we used to do all the time that didn't kill us, that we stopped doing, that made us sick, that now we're told not to do, all seem to be killing us again. So yeah. I'm very suspicious. And that's why I wrote the article, because I think this is an excellent example of something that hit the mainstream that's probably, first of all, not true. And second of all, probably meant to make us more sick.
I've said the American Medical Association, it's the American Heart Association that came out with this. And by the way, it's the same American Heart Association that endorses that wonderful health food, Cheerios. They've got, it's a joke. It's a complete joke. Michael, what's your perspective on intermittent or even regular fasting?
I think it's very much consistent with what humans had to do, not out of choice, but because there wasn't any food around. So I think it's very much a useful tool. I think it can be overdone, in particular if you're a female, or maybe during certain phases of your menstrual cycle, maybe starting a 2-day fast and hopping into the cold plunge might not be a good idea. But of course, there is, especially on social media, all nuance is missing. There is no context, no nuance, either black or white. And I practice both, not necessarily because I force myself to do so, but like today, I've only had one meal. I'm not hungry. Why would I eat if I'm not hungry? So I eat tomorrow morning again. So I effectively intermittently fast, and it's likely going to be very good for me because otherwise I would be hungry if my body needed fuel. And my wife is the same. And the same goes with cold plunging. We do all of those things. And trying to really bring in a certain amount of randomness. I don't cold plunge every single day at the same time, because that's also not realistic based on maybe earlier humans might have experienced in terms of, you know, being cold or being without food. But doing this on a somewhat random but frequent basis, I think is great. I mean, I've yet to meet anyone who had any negative impact from not eating for a while. Or being exposed to cold or hot temperatures.
For sure. Not eating and being hungry, I think, is important. Yeah. I think it was either Peter Attia or Andrew Huberman who made the comment that disease really is the relentless pursuit of comfort. We stay on our couch. We don't exercise. Yeah. We sleep in. We don't wake up early to exercise. It's too cold outside, so we don't go out in the sun and so forth. And we've been trained that we should be comfortable. And we should do everything we can to prevent being uncomfortable, which right. is really necessary for our body to grow strong. Not unlike, and the listeners will understand this, when you work out, you need to stress and make your muscles uncomfortable, break them down somewhat so they can rebuild and grow your immune system. If your immune system isn't regularly being challenged, it won't stay strong. One of the detriments of COVID and locking everybody indoors and keeping them away was that, especially our children, we prevented them from being exposed just to the natural germs of the day. And as a result, it caused all kinds of problems. And so this relentless pursuit of comfort is contrary to what we should be doing. We should be out there in nature and exposing ourselves to cold and to hunger. We should be exercising, stressing our bodies, stressing our immune system. That's the way we stay strong. And that's the way we prevent ourselves from injury.
We interrupt this podcast for an important segment.
Informed Dissent is proud to announce a new sponsor. Are you tired of skincare products filled with harmful chemicals and additives? Do you long for natural, wholesome solutions that are safe for your skin and the environment? Tallow. I've been using tallow cream for a long time. Tallow is a form of beef fat, and it is one of the most wonderful moisturizing products you could put on your skin, your hands, your face, your elbows, your feet. It is fantastic. Introducing Dandy Natural, a mother and daughter small business located right here in Newport Beach, California. They're dedicated to crafting all natural skincare products that are as pure as they are effective. Pamper your skin with their lavender and honey tallow balm, or use one of their products that I helped create with them. RX for Liberty Peppermint Tallow. It has a hint of peppermint and that sense of coolness when you put it on. That's the product I use every day. DandyNatural.com. Give it a go and let us know what you think.
Use the code IDM to get 10% off.
On your Instagram site, you are a proponent of red light therapy. Tell us about that. What are the benefits of red light therapy?
I mean, there are so many robust studies that show the benefits in multiple areas. I use it predominantly, well, we have bees, so I get stung by bees all the time. And I'm not allergic, but I'm very sensitive. So I blow up like nothing else. Just got stung the other day and I looked like an elephant on my ankle because I didn't use red light therapy. But when I do, immediately after being stung, I don't react to the bee sting. So that's one of the use cases I have for red light therapy. To not be as uncomfortable after a bee sting, or not as dysfunctional, I should say. But also you mentioned CrossFit before we went live. I do CrossFit as well. I get injured from time to time. I have tweaks and et cetera. So I use it very often to just get additional oxygenated blood flow into certain areas, especially those that don't have a lot of blood flow as it is, like my Achilles tendon, for example, but also for just cosmetic reasons. And that's mostly my wife, I want to say, but I've been using red light therapy for really most of the use case, and I've seen great success with all of them.
Red light therapy, by the way, has as recently as just last week produced a study that was, I believe, reported in the Epoch Times as being beneficial to the treatment of depression. And I'm a psychiatrist, so I treat that as an emotional condition. And sometimes it's an illness if it's a clinical depression, but apparently red light therapy and heating in general, heating the body helps to reduce symptoms of depression. Just 2 20-minute a day heat experiences, either red light or our 103-degree bathtub or jacuzzi, reduce the incidence of depression. I mean, who would have thought? And yet it appears to be helpful.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Michael Coomer, who is basically a blogger and a health coach. His Instagram site is mcoomer, K-U-M-M-E-R 82. And his tagline is helping you improve your health and longevity. I follow a lot of social media influencers, health influencers on Instagram and elsewhere, and I've learned a lot from them. Gary Brecka has really emerged on the scene. He's really smart and I think has some important things to say. Andrew Huberman, Peter Attia, and others. Who do you look for advice and to kind of stay up on top of what the latest technology and information is for longevity and health?
Yeah, I mean, I follow Huberman as well. I follow Saladino. Anthony Gustin has always had very good type of like no-nonsense information, way less, I guess, hyped up than maybe sometimes you can get from Paul Saladino and some others. But those are typically the ones that, and then whatever, you know, the algorithm recommends. Very often I see stuff that I don't follow those people, but the algorithm thinks I should. And so I get like a one-off, and if I see something interesting, then I do follow. But yeah, those are the few that I stay up.
You mentioned CrossFit and injury and strategies, including red light therapy to help yourself heal. What about things like bioidentical hormones for men and women? And there's really been an emergence over the last couple of years about the use of peptides. Mm-hmm. Peptides, of course, if you're listening, are short chain amino acids. probably the most well-known is semaglutide, and the commercially available products for weight loss like Wegovy, Mounjaro, Ozempic, and the like. Those are all peptides, but now there are other peptides that are being used to help heal injury, help boost growth hormone naturally, and so forth. Any thoughts on peptide use?
I've never really spent enough time to investigate that. I've been offered several times to try some stuff, and I've always said, no, thanks, I'm good, simply because I never, you know, saw the need personally for myself. But recently I came across an interesting research paper, I think out of Russia, surrounding Epitalon. And so I started experimenting with that. I don't know yet if it works or not. I just started a couple of weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, actually. So I might do another epigenetic test in a couple of months or maybe in a year to see if it moved the needle at all. But the doctor I work with told me that's one of the things where we can have a conversation in 30 years to figure out if it worked or not. So I'm not sure if I'll ever find out if it works, but that's at least something that I'm experimenting with right now.
And what are any thoughts on bioidentical hormones? There's a lot of men that want testosterone replacement, even women, and women 50, 60 years old going through menopause, and they want to use bioidentical progesterone and even estrogen.
Yeah, I mean, I've experimented with testosterone 2 years ago to see, as part of really an anti-aging, not so much to look any different as far as my physique is concerned. And I decided that it's not a good idea for me. And I do think that it's likely not a good idea for others as well, just because most hormones, there is a negative feedback loop. Whatever you put into your body from the outside, anything exogenous, typically suppresses then what's happening inside of your body. And I don't really like the idea of permanently suppressing, even if you take HCG and some other stuff in combination with that. I've noticed with my experimentation, it was fairly low dosed, that it took me forever to start producing testosterone again. And I'm like, and this was only after a year of doing it. I'm like, who knows what's going to happen if I do this for 10 years? Right. I might never restart my own production, or not to the same extent. And so I stopped doing that. But I do still do HCG. I seem to be responding fairly well to get me like to 1,000 or so. What is it? Nanogram per deciliter or so, whatever the total testosterone unit is. And so that's within the quote unquote normal range, if there is such a thing, because nobody really seems to know what the normal range is supposed to be. It might still be on the upper, you know, limit of that. But I seem to be doing fairly well as far as my exercise recovery is concerned and everything else too. I haven't really noticed a difference in my physique, because a lot of people say, oh, that's why you look like you do. But then I, you know, pulled out a picture from 2019 where, you know, I took nothing and I looked just the same muscle volume, same, you know, body fat and everything. So I don't think it did anything there, but I can clearly tell my recovery has sped up. I'm 42 years and pushing it in the gym. I've noticed it has been taking longer and longer to get back to zero and do it again. And with the HCG, it has helped in that regard.
Yeah, very good. Mark and I have been spending a lot of time learning about and promoting a variety of supplements that we both use and that we advocate for our patients. I know you are also into supplements. What are some of the important supplements that you think people should know about?
I mean, out of self-interest, I would say that if you don't consume fresh organ meats, maybe freeze-dried beef organ supplements or bison organ supplements for that matter, maybe not a bad idea to cover your micronutrient needs that you might not be able to cover with regular diet, depending on how you eat. I like creatine, especially if you exercise, but also just from an energy production, ATP perspective, even if you're not into fitness. I think that is almost a no-brainer with very few, if any, side effects. Maybe loose stools if you take too much. Electrolytes in particular, again, depending on what diet you're on and how much salt you consume through your diet. But I like to supplement with electrolytes, especially when I work out or sauna bathe and sweat more than maybe the average person. And magnesium, I mean, it's an electrolyte, but that has been working well. Besides that, we've been experimenting with collagen and colostrum. That's been going well. I can clearly tell you, I don't know if it's a benefit necessarily, that my nails and my hair are going faster, so I have to get more haircuts, but it seems to be doing something in collagen in particular. And it's not really a supplement, but raw honey during the colder months of the year already has had a dramatic impact on my wife's and our little one's allergy symptoms than in spring. And we have our own bees. So it's honey that our bees produce from the area with pollen from the area. So that's something.
Yeah, I want people to hear that. If you struggle with allergies, one strategy, there's a lot of strategies, but one strategy is local honey, raw honey, because the bees pollinate the local flowers. And that honey, in effect, is a almost like an allergy desensitization product.
Right.
Not to mention that it's just delicious, raw honey in particular. Never pasteurized honey, always raw, just like raw milk. And if you don't grow your own bees, raise your own bees, whatever the term is, you can go to your local farmer's market and get honey from your local area that's produced. So that is a great strategy. So you mentioned that you raise your own bees and you mentioned homesteading. Tell us about your homesteading.
Yeah, I mean, along the way, we figured out that everyone talks about what you should be eating and where you should be sourcing your meat from, et cetera. And I'm like, well, it's great. But first of all, it's very expensive to buy the type of meat that we'd like to consume, and eggs and butter and anything in between. Really, all the good stuff is fairly expensive. And then you still have no control over the food supply. What if something happens and suddenly you don't get your eggs and your meat anymore? Or now meat's going to be taxed and it's going to be so expensive that you can't afford it anymore. And then occasionally it turns out that you were promised a grass-fed, grass-finished beef, but it wasn't really. It was still grain-fed or whatever the case might be. I'm like, okay, so we got to take control of our food supply. And the best way of doing that is by raising your own protein and carbohydrates, maybe. And have full control and know exactly what goes into that. And in particular with beef, I think it's easier to just buy good quality beef in the grocery store from your local farmer, whatever. But we've noticed, particularly with poultry or monogastric animals in general, you can't get it. I mean, the type of chicken meat that I'd like to eat, the type of eggs that I'd like to eat, I couldn't find anywhere. And that's mostly because the feed that those animals are fed, it is usually high in PUFAs. It might be organic, it might be corn and soy free, but it's then it has vegetable oils to bind the minerals to the grains. And so you basically get your canola oil through the chicken meat. And I don't care much for that. And so we decided we need to do that ourselves and raise the food ourselves and have full control over the supply chain.
So you raise chickens for eggs, you raise chicken for meat as well?
Yes, we actually just started our first batch. They're 2 weeks old now. They're still in the brooder. So we have the first 32 birds that we're going to butcher in a couple of months. But then we have 40 egg layers plus the 30 meat birds and a couple of geese and rabbits and bees and turkeys in June for Thanksgiving.
Wow. Will you slaughter these birds yourself?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've done all the processing ourselves.
How'd you learn how to do that?
YouTube.
Do you have cows as well?
Not yet. No, we don't have to. We only have an acre and a quarter right now. So there is no space for anything more than what we have. But we purchased 45 acres last year and we'll be moving there next year or the year after, depending on how quickly the bill and everything is going to go. And then we'll be doing cows, maybe bison, but definitely dairy cows and probably also beef cattle.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah. And Mark, you figured out a strategy to have a supply of healthy beef. Tell us about that. And how is that going?
Well, this raises like a solution and also a problem for the healthy lifestyle. My solution as a city dweller is to purchase pieces of cow. In my case, I purchased a quarter of a cow, which is about 80 pounds of net meat from a man who purchases Angus beef that are grown in Idaho and then wintered in Arizona and then slaughtered on site, butchered after having been hang dried for about a week, 2 weeks, and then packaged in freezer packs and labeled not for sale. They're all labeled not for sale because this is all sort of off market purchase. And then he delivers them to you in a pickup truck in a freezer, and you put them in your freezer and you take them home and you keep them there for 3, 6, 9 months, as long as you need. And you thaw them out. I have a sous vide system, so I don't need to worry about timing my cooking. I just throw a package of meat, 2, 4, 6 pounds of meat in for 2, 4, 6, 8 hours in the sous vide to pull it out whenever I'm ready to eat and cook it and sear it over an iron skillet. And you don't really even need much except some butter and spices. He also sells chickens and eggs from his farm out here in Southern California.
How's the quality and taste?
So you and I had been subscribed for some time to a mail order beef program that was grass fed, healthy, not genetically engineered grain fed beef, but really healthy beef, mostly ribeyes. And they were about $20 a pound or so. And they're delicious, very, very easy to cook. You don't really need any seasonings, very healthy. And I was concerned because I've heard some stories, including one from one of your family members, that people who buy, your daughter actually bought a whole cow. And
They bought I can't remember if it was a half or a quarter. I just talked to her last night or the other night about this. And she said they're so disappointed because they don't really look forward to eating the meat. The ground beef is okay because you can season it, but it's just not good. And they were going to reach out to the person that sold them the beef and complain. Now, I don't know whether they'll get their money back or whatever. And they've got a freezer full of beef. They don't want to throw it away, but they don't really like to eat it. And they didn't try it ahead of time.
This is a problem that I hear a lot of people having. And so even if you're lucky and you get good quality meat that is actually from a, I didn't realize this, I had to learn this from the seller, from a steer, there's actually not just, you actually don't want cow meat. Cows are or female animals that have given birth. And those are the wrong type of animal to buy. Heifers are female cows that have not given birth, which you also don't want to buy. And then steers are male cows or male animals that have not been used for breeding, which is a fourth type of animal, which you also don't want to eat. So the actual so-called cow that you want to eat is a very narrow range of sex and age of meat. And of course, the raising of it and how it's fed is also important. But I'm paying $12 on average a pound for this meat, $18 for the nicer cuts, $8 for the ground beefs on average of 12. I can afford it. I can also afford $25.
How much per pound?
About $12 a pound on average for the beef.
And this other company that you and I both were using, I'm still using, was $20 per pound?
It's 20, but that was just for ribeye.
Okay, gotcha.
So if you figure that half of the meat is ground beef, which is probably about $8, and the rest of the cuts are somewhere like 16, the average is 12, which is a lot of money actually for beef when you compare it to what you get in the store. Now, I know it's not the same quality, but my point is that, you know, per pound, if you're a parent with a couple of kids and you want to put together a dinner, you're going to be spending $100 for a dinner for a family of four or five people for good quality meat. That's really not affordable. It's assuming you get the good quality meat, not the stuff your daughter got. So one of the challenges I had for Michael, or really a question, is for people who live in cities and they don't have the space to homestead and they do want to eat healthy and they want to buy good eggs and butter and unpasteurized milk and, you know, goat milk. Goat milk is $3.50 for I think it's just a quart. That's like $12 a gallon. Now, if you've got a family of six and you go through a gallon of milk every day, this really becomes, essentially, it's unaffordable. So do you have any thoughts, Michael, on how people in cities, especially people with families or people who don't have six-figure salaries, can find ways to actually be healthy without breaking the bank? I don't want healthy life to be the domain of rich people, which it seems right to be heading that way, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think you mentioned it before, the ribeye is significantly more expensive than the ground meat. I mean, nutritionally, there is no need to eat ribeye. You get the same nutrients from ground meat. So from a pure health perspective, buying the less expensive cuts, even stew meat, buy a slow cooker. Whatever you throw into the slow cooker comes out delicious. It doesn't really matter what it is and how tough the meat was to begin with. And so that's one recommendation, is to purchase roasts and cheaper cuts and ground meat. There are certain stores, even Walmart here in Georgia, at least, they sell U.S. domestic grass-fed, grass-finished meat for ground meat for like $5 a pound. It might not be the same taste as the one from the farm around the corner, true, but I also believe from a nutritional perspective, I don't think it's that far behind. And if that is too expensive as well, I would say that eating any meat from a ruminant animal that has not been subjected to hormones and to some of the nasty stuff that you absolutely don't want to have in your meat, even if it's grain fed, it's better than the alternative, meaning not eating meat.
How about crickets?
I mean, if that's your thing, I'd rather prefer red meat over crickets, but I wouldn't make that my primary protein source. But if you find one in your backyard, by all means, eat it. So, and with eggs, it's what I would do is I would definitely try to steer clear of the meat of monogastric animals, because the cheaper, even the highest quality you can find is still not up to par in terms of fatty acid composition. Any ground meat from a ruminant animal that you find at Costco is better than most of the premium chicken you can
Michael,
find.
Michael, define that a little bit for our listeners. You said monogastric animals versus ruminant animals.
Yeah.
Tell us what that means.
Well, what it basically means, if an animal can eat grass and then convert that grass into protein and fatty acids, rearrange the amino acids, rearrange the fatty acids in the feed to make it work for them, convert this into saturated fatty acids. That's a good thing, because that means the
that's a cow.
That's a cow, for example, or
a bison.
Bison, or, yeah. Elk. No, maybe not elk. Or elk? Elk
I
or
think they're all ruminants. Yeah.
They're ruminants as well?
Yeah, yeah, they're all. But monogastric, on the other hand, they are what they eat, much like humans.
What is an example of a monogastric animal?
Poultry, pork in particular, or pigs. But the pork that you get from a pig, that has typically a fatty acid composition that very much mimics the feed of the animal. And unfortunately, unless it's a wild boar, different story, a wild turkey, but anything that's farm raised is typically fed feed that is high in polyunsaturated fatty acids, in particular linoleic acid.
Beef is healthier than pork.
Yes. I would say that any beef, even if it's grain fed, is a better choice than consuming a pastured pork, quote unquote, knowing that that pastured pork likely got a diet that's high in PUFAs.
Do you not eat pork?
I do eat it occasionally, but not to the extent that I used to ever since I discovered that the fatty acid composition in pork and chicken, for that matter, is just awful. And one of the reasons why we decided to raise our own chickens, because the kids like chicken meat, so we have at least that covered. And then with pork, we'll have to wait until we own the new property and have the space to raise pigs as well.
Got it. That's outstanding. So we're almost at 40 minutes. We usually try to stop around 30. Michael, how can people follow you or find you if they want to connect with you and hire you as a coach?
Well, I'm actually not for hire because I don't have the bandwidth to do one-on-one coaching. That's why I have the blog and the Instagram and the podcast to kind of help people. I do respond to comments and to emails, obviously, but I don't really do one-on-one coaching. But where people can find me is michaelcoomer.com. That's the blog. Where I put out most of my written content. The Primal Shift podcast is where I bridge the gap between social media and blog. Anything that doesn't necessarily have to rank organically goes on the podcast.
How do you monetize then what you're doing?
So on the blog, it's a lot of affiliates. I write about products that I really like and use, and I have affiliate relationships with those. There are some programmatic display ads that are out of my control. So you see what the algorithm thinks you're interested in. And that's predominantly my income. And then we have MK supplements, the freeze-dried beef organ supplements. And that's my second income stream.
Got it. Well, outstanding. Well, listen, you're a wealth of knowledge, certainly right in alignment with what Mark and I believe and how we live our lives as well. And we'll continue to follow you and look forward to talking to you again in the future. So welcome and thank you for joining us on Informed Dissent.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yep, you got it.
You've been listening to Informed Dissent with Dr. Jeff Barkey, board-certified primary care physician, and Dr. Mark McDonald, board-certified child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist. Informed Dissent, the intersection of healthcare and politics.